When you send me packing down in Green River Valley, I knew that if you couldn't, then no one would have me. Lost myself drinking with those state.
Welcome to Mile High Stash. This is Adam, and this is the podcast where we ask what five albums you would take to a remote Colorado cabin in the event of a zombie apocalypse, armed only with food, water, and a crank-powered Victrola. It's now May 2024. I've been slowing down a little lately. Obviously, I'm only doing the podcast once a month now to, save my life, basically. I've been working and playing softball and biking, playing drums with a few groups here and there, including at the wonderful Foco MX Festival in Fort Collins a few weeks ago. I'll be playing the drums with the Hunter Stone Band on Friday, May 18th at Mountain Sun in Boulder. Today, though, I'm here to share something totally different. My conversation with Colorado native Eric Eyl, that's E-R-Y-C-E-Y-L, who's well-known in the Denver, Boulder, Fort Collins areas as a DJ and MC, and also a business consultant. He's got really big ideas and big solutions on what makes human-centric workplaces happen. He's also got the best mustache west of the Mississippi. Eric's debut book, Stop Engaging Employees, is out now, and we talked about that. I love talking about music with Eric, and you'll hear us doing that in this conversation, of course. But I also love hearing him talk about how workplaces can serve humans instead of humans serving workplaces, whether that's an office or a band or a school. Should we be allowed or even encouraged to bring ourselves to the workplace? Of course, on top of explaining how work can be more than a four-letter word, Eric also gave me his five albums he'd bring to a remote Colorado cabin in the event of a zombie apocalypse. Anyway, please do check out Eric Eyl's new book, Stop Engaging Employees, wherever you buy books. And if you can, as always, please drop a review of Mile High Stash on Apple Podcasts, or even drop me a few bucks via the donate button at milehighstash.com so I can have even a little budget to keep this thing going. All right, here's my chat with speaker, author, DJ, coach, consultant, Eric Eyl.
Dude, I'm narrating the audiobook right now.
Yeah.
It's so painful.
Why is it painful?
Well, so I don't know if you know this. My wife, that's what she does, like, for life. She's an audiobook narrator. And a voiceover actor.
It's painful because she's criticizing
you. No, not at all. Not at all. She got me all set up. I'm using her studio, which is a closet in our house, you know. And she, she gave me coaching. And, like, the first, I recorded, like, a couple chapters and had her listen, and she was like, no.
Yeah.
She's like, here's three things you're doing, And so actually I'm re-recording the whole thing right now.
Yeah.
And it's so doing long form, like staying in relationship to the microphone, first of all.
Oh yeah.
Like just staying in that same relationship with the microphone. Cause you hear this, like you hear that.
Oh yeah.
Like so much. And then just like trying to be mindful of breath and swallowing and stomach gurgles,
dry throat, and not sneezing.
Yesterday it was. Do you know what borborygmia is?
No idea. No.
Borborygmia is stomach rumbling.
Yeah.
It's just a great word, I think. Borborygmi.
I mean, that's just fun to say.
Singular is borborygmus, which is even more fun to say, I think. But yeah, yesterday, so I'm listening, I'm monitoring while I'm doing the vocals, right, while I'm doing this. And I can't hear my stomach except through the headphones. Mm. I'm like, God damn it. Like, that was a perfect take. Now I got to go back and do that all over again.
Yeah, but if you have a good editor, they're just going to take care of all that stuff.
Yeah. But I don't.
No, you don't. Yeah, neither do I.
Yeah,
neither
I'm doing everything kind of DIY. So.
Yeah. I remember I had done like 6 or 7 episodes of this, and the sound guy was backstage at the Caribou Room when I was playing there on New Year's last year, and he was like, do you realize that most of these shows have somebody who does the interviews and then somebody who books the guest and then somebody who edits and then somebody who does the marketing? And I was like, no, I just do all of that stuff. You know?
So, yeah. I would say probably most podcasts, that's the case. It's
one
person just making it all happen.
Yeah.
Until you get to a level where you can
you almost lose your entire family and your job and everything. Yeah. Probably.
Yeah. Right. Your health. Yeah.
So correct me if I'm wrong.
Yep.
Eric Isle.
Isle. Yep.
Okay.
Nailed it.
And what's your middle name? Is it another E? That would be amazing.
That would be cool. It's William.
Oh, well, that's classy. That's good.
My dad's name.
Yeah. So tell me your story. Where are you from originally?
I was born in Boulder.
You're born in Boulder?
I was born in Boulder.
Where did you go to, all those schools, Horizons?
Yeah, I didn't. No, I didn't. So I was born in Boulder, and my parents moved out of Boulder when I was 1 to west of Berthoud.
Okay.
And I grew up there.
What's the name of the town?
It's Berthoud. It's mailing address is Berthoud, but it's 5 acres in the country.
Yeah. Have you had any stretches where you didn't live in Colorado?
College.
Where'd you go?
Vassar.
Where is Vassar?
Poughkeepsie, New York.
Oh, nice.
So about an hour outside, hour and a half outside of New York City.
Yeah.
And then right after college, I lived in Austin for a spell.
Nice.
1994.
Yeah, I mean, that was apparently really, that's the best time ever to live in Austin.
Dude, I mean, it was, I haven't been back much. Mm-hmm. I've been back maybe once since then. So I don't even know. I can't compare.
It's just huge.
But it's
probably 10 times as big as it was.
And insanely expensive. Yeah. Insanely expensive. Yeah. But when I was there, the story I always like to tell of what was it like there? Because I was there for South by Southwest, 1994.
Yeah.
And Emo's still existed, which, famous 6th Street Club. And they had a front room and a back room. And I walk into the front room, and Beck is just in the corner playing.
Mm.
To no one.
Yeah.
No one's paying any attention. And then I go into the big room, and Johnny Cash is playing.
Wow.
That's incredible. That's what Austin was. But I also went very broke. I moved there because a friend of mine wanted me to help him produce a children's television show.
Wow.
Cool. But he didn't have any funding. It was producing a pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not have the means to just sort of subsist on temp jobs and stuff. And so I went broke and moved back here.
Yeah.
And then it was oh, wait, this area is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
And then you know how life goes. You meet somebody, you have a kid, you stay put.
So how long have you been together?
Well, I'm not with the person with whom I had the kid.
Yeah, but
Yeah. So my current wife, the audiobook narrator, voiceover actor, she and I have been together since 2008.
Well, shit,
a good long time.
15 years.
Yeah, a good long time.
So you have a child who's older than that?
I have a child who is 19.
19?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He or she or they?
She's she's at CU.
Yeah?
Studying music education.
Wow. Well, that seems like a big success.
It's cool.
It's fantastic.
It's cool, yeah.
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 My kid is 14 and
14, okay, yeah,
and is deciding on where to go to high school and doing all the open enrollment
stuff. Okay, here in town or okay,
hopefully if this goes out in the world and somebody at New Vista High School wants to accept my kid, that would be great.
New Vista is a cool school.
Yeah,
as I went to graduate school to become a high school teacher.
Mm-hmm.
I have a master's in education.
Yeah.
Weird thing about me. At CU, I went to CU Boulder for my master's. And at that time, I graduated 2000. At that time, New Vista was pretty new.
Yeah.
And it was so cool. I don't know today. It's a different location. Everything's different.
Great.
But like I had friends who student taught there. I had friends who substitute taught there. Just loved it. Like loved it as a teacher. I knew students who went there who loved it.
Yeah.
But you know, we're very lucky in this area to have lots of good schools.
Yeah, I don't think any of them are shit, which is good. That, you know, because if she doesn't get into her first two choices, it's not like the other ones are bad. But
right,
my partner of 5 years and counting
and went, counting. Good, I'm glad you're still counting.
Went to New Vista.
And oh, okay.
Just okay. has been telling my daughter about that ever since we met. And it just seems like the perfect place for the beautiful weirdos.
Right.
Seems great.
You know? Where'd you grow up at?
Yeah. Pittsburgh, PA.
Oh, right. Yeah, I guess I knew that about you.
Yeah. And then I spent my 20s in San Francisco, so I feel like I'm from both of those places.
Okay.
And then, similarly, you know, like you go somewhere and you think you're just going to be somewhere for a little bit and then meet somebody and have a kid and then... Never leave.
Yep, that's roots, man. Yeah. That's roots. Yeah. Well, yeah. My wife, before she moved to Denver, she'd never lived anywhere longer than like a couple of years.
Wow.
She, even as a kid, like she moved around as a kid and she grew up all over the place. And then as an adult, she was in San Francisco and Seattle and Paris. And she moved to Denver with her ex-husband and was like, I'll be here a couple of years. And she had been here for like 8 years by the time I met her.
Wow. And yeah, my whole thing was I had such a hard time focusing on school when I lived in San Francisco because I was in all these bands and I would just get distracted.
So
by
much
stuff.
Going on, yeah, of course.
And then I heard about this school where as electives you could take like Zen Buddhism or like yoga or whatever instead of geometry. And then I could just, you know, study writing, which is what I wanted to study, English, you know, but then not have to, you know, take these electives that had nothing to do with what I do with my life. So I was like, oh, I'll go there for a year and then I'll go right back to California. So that was...
That was Naropa.
16 years ago.
So Naropa is what drew you out here.
Yeah.
Far out.
Yeah.
That's amazing. And did you have a good experience at Naropa?
I think if you don't have a love-hate relationship with it, there's something wrong with you. Like, I'd be worried about you either way.
Yeah.
So, when I pay off my student loans, I don't necessarily think of the formal education I got as much as I think of all the relationships that I made.
Yeah.
That, you know,
yeah.
To this day, I mean, have just, like, shaped my life. And I wouldn't have... like the special thing about Naropa is that there are experiences you can have there that you absolutely cannot have at any other school.
Mm-hmm.
And there are things that really suck about it and it's mismanaged and there's bad things about it. You know?
Right.
But
right.
It was a good decision in the long run.
And that kept you here. So
yeah,
I know I'm not supposed to be interviewing you. I'm just curious. did you have a focus at Naropa?
Oh, I knew that I wanted to be in the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics and study English.
That's what year was this?
2008 and 2009.
Okay.
Yeah, I was only there for like a year and a half.
Yeah. Do you have things like practices in your life that you've retained from Naropa life?
The three prajñas. I try to do that.
Okay.
Do you know what that is?
I know like this much about it. Yeah, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean it's just...
I've had friends who are faculty there.
I mean, I just, when you're in the Kerouac school, you're like the renegade part of Naropa, you know, like.
But kind of the original part of Naropa in some ways, right?
And like, I would argue that the summer writing program is the best part of Naropa.
Yeah.
But, you know, you don't have to buy in completely is how I feel. Some of the things that if you're in the religious studies program or studying yoga or whatever. So I like that about it. And I got to be exposed to Buddhism and Shambhala specifically on a very I wouldn't say a minuscule level, but just kind of dipping your toes in. Mm-hmm. And that's the first thing I think of is, you know, these three things when you're having a conversation, and I'm sure I fail at it a lot. But the first thing is to actually listen.
Yeah.
And the second thing is to kind of just like think about it and process it. And the third is to respond. Or not. You know, but
which is a response, right?
Yeah, yeah, but yeah. So many people,
but choose your response, right? Yeah. That's the practice.
So many people, but especially in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Ironically, it's like they're going to the third thing immediately. You know what I mean?
And, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I try to really, when somebody is telling me about themselves or their ideas or their thoughts or their feelings and experiences, I'm trying to do that first step and not like skip ahead, which sometimes, you know, when you're doing an interview and it's like you're pressed for time.
Yeah, right.
You know you have this much time with somebody.
Yeah.
You do kind of have to hold these things in your head like, okay, I am listening, but as soon as you stop talking, I know what I'm going to say in order to move it along.
Right, which can take away from that listening.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
I actually, there's a chapter in my book all about listening.
Yeah.
And it's very much what we're talking about because you know, and all I say is that, like, in our lives, in this culture, mm-hmm. we are rarely called upon to listen well.
Right.
So our muscles aren't that strong.
Yeah.
Like, we're just not that strong, you know? And so it does take deliberate practice. Mm-hmm. It takes having a framework like that to say, oh, right, I listen. And in order to listen well, I have to not be thinking about the next thing I'm going to say. I have to not be just waiting for my turn to talk.
Right? Yeah.
And that's really hard to do. Like, we're not developed at that. It's not something that we've been taught. It's not something that we've been, and in the workplace, like, forget about it. Like,
I was just going to say, especially like I've worked in a lot of newsrooms and you're just like, every moment is precious. And it's like, what do you got for me right now? It's not
react. Right. Yeah.
And in the music industry too. I mean, I've had, Don Strasberg at the Fox on the phone and had him say those exact words to me. What do you got for me, Chiefs? It's not like, how's it going? You know, let's have a conversation. So, that I'm interested in how you got interested in this stuff about. I don't want to use the term mindful workplace because that's
interesting. I have that applied, but okay, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But that, I mean, I think you're in the universe of that.
Yeah.
But like, how did you get interested in that? And then how do you apply it in such disparate situations? You know, because it could apply to a bunch of people in the kitchen at like Snarf's, or
yes,
it could apply to a startup, or, you know, you could walk into Google and they would say, oh, we want you to talk to our people.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I should be clear, like, the world I know is the world of like corporate so-called white collar. Right. That said, you're absolutely right. This isn't unique to that environment. It's just the world I know. So I am seeking ways to apply this in Snarfs or, you know, but the way that I came to this, there's a few different ways to tell that story. But I think I never saw myself working in corporate at all.
Mm-hmm.
I went to school to become a writer, envisioned myself as a beautiful weirdo who would never fit into corporate life. Right. And literally took a temp job at a company in Boulder because it was walking distance from where I was living.
Mm-hmm.
That was the whole decision, right? When I was 25 or whatever.
What was the job?
So it's a company called Access Graphics,
uh-huh.
Which was owned by John Ramsey, father of JonBenet Ramsey.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I started temping there months after the murder.
Mm.
I was on the Pearl Street Mall. And it was actually owned... It was not owned by John Ramsey. He had sold it years before to Lockheed Martin.
Wow.
So Boulder's Access Graphics was actually owned by Lockheed Martin. Lockheed Martin did nothing with it except make money. The company was a IT distribution company. They sold servers. And so I got a job there. And then months after I started working there, Lockheed sold it to GE. So I ended up working for GE.
Wow.
At the time, this is late 90s, GE is like the biggest corporation in the world at that time.
Yeah.
Huge. Jack Welch, all that baggage.
CBS too, right?
NBC. They bought NBC during the time I was there, a little bit later. Yeah. Yeah, they bought NBC. Super weird. So I started working there, and I was like, well, if I'm going to work for this gigantic corporation, I'm going to get everything I can out of it. Mm-hmm. Like, I am nothing if not a passionate learner. Like, I just love learning stuff. So I was like, teach me. And at that time, GE was really investing in employee development, in mm-hmm. training. And so they would send you to trainings. And I remember the first training that I got sent to, it was like required actually, was time management. Mm. And it was like the Franklin Planner, which now is like Franklin Covey. It was a Franklin Planner, Benjamin Franklin. And I was like, they're only sending me to this so they can get more out of me. You know, like they're just like, they just want to extract more. They're just, you know, time management is just like, and went to the class and the first thing they were like, so let's talk about what you really care about in life. And I was like, oh shit. Like you can do that at work, you know?
Right. That's not a part of work.
I didn't know, you know? And so I was like, oh, well, okay. So this can be a positive thing. But then where I actually came to this work that I do now was, at GE at the time, there was this thing called Six Sigma, which still exists when it wasn't unique to GE, but it was a method of business process improvement, highly statistical, highly data driven. And at GE, it was like a religion. And like everybody had to, like if you wanted to go anywhere, you had to know this stuff. And I wanted to get a position in another country. Like I work for GE, they can just
send you anywhere.
Send me anywhere. Mm-hmm. So in order to do that, they're like, well, you got to have this Six Sigma stuff. So I became a Six Sigma black belt. That's what they actually call it.
Hmm.
You go through rigorous training, tests, projects, all this stuff to attain this. And my first project as a black belt was like, improve this process over here, this business process. But what I realized really quickly was all that data and all that analysis and all that wasn't going to change anything if people didn't do things differently.
Right.
And I realized, like, oh, companies are a bunch of people.
Yeah.
And so that became really interesting to me. And I went through a few different related disciplines before I finally got to workplace culture as the place where I really focus.
Yeah.
But all of it is about just humans at the center of the conversation about work.
Yeah.
And that to me... You know, people always say, like, you don't come to your work without some sort of related suffering. And certainly I've had my share of, like, really awful work experiences.
Yeah, me too.
Right, exactly. That made me all the more interested in how can you make it not be the case? Right? How can work be... My glib way of saying it is, how can work be more than just a four-letter word, right? How can we make work not something we're trying to minimize in our lives, but something that actually... like helps us become better people.
Do you know the movie Joe versus the Volcano?
I don't.
This is my favorite movie of all time.
Oh, okay.
By far. And all right. I've had for a decade, I have a print of art inspired by this movie.
Okay.
Above my bed.
But yes.
It was the first Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan movie.
Okay.
That is fucking weird.
Great.
And it's so quirky and surreal and science fiction, you know. But the first scene of the movie is Tom Hanks. He's this guy. He's like a hypochondriac, and he's convinced, always convinced that he's dying.
Right.
And his job is so bad. Just that it's comically, everything about the job is so bad. There's one light bulb, and it's always just like going.
Right.
And the coffee is like syrup, you know. And every day that he's there, he's just... saying to his boss, I feel terrible. I don't know what it is, but I feel terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And his boss just goes, we all feel terrible. It's just like, get over it. So when you said like it can be a positive experience, you don't have to associate work with misery.
Yeah.
When did you, you know, start to have that focus on like workplace culture, and how did you realize that something like time management is separate from workplace culture? Because my assumption is that for many years, nobody even talked about this stuff.
Yes.
You know, and maybe they did start to talk about, okay, we need to have things like team building and work on time management, but still didn't see the humanity of the culture of it.
Yeah. I mean, this has been a journey for me for sure. And I think, I mean, as you know, I wrote for years about work-life balance.
Yeah, yeah.
And these things are all related to me. All of this stuff is related. And it comes from this conviction that I have that work is an intrinsically human activity. Mm-hmm. It is, but I define work differently. So I think that's part of it, is I've come to this notion that like we are all here with our work to do.
Hmm.
And that's different from your job.
How often? Yeah, and how ideally. Often is the work that you're here to do, how often is that what pays the bills?
Exactly. You know? Absolutely. And I think that's part of like there's a tendency to say, you know, when I talk about things like this, it comes from a place of privilege. I do come from a place of privilege. I mean, you know, like we're sitting here today, you know, we're comfortable, we're warm, we have a roof.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think sometimes we do our job for instrumentarian reasons, that is to pay the bills, to make the money, to survive.
Yeah.
And we still have our work. We still have the thing we're set here to do. Even if that thing that we believe is our work is taking care of other people. And so I've thought about this a lot since my dad passed away November 2022.
No, I'm sorry.
Thank you. So about a year ago. My dad had more like disparate jobs than a lot of people. Like he was a marine geologist.
Wow.
A vet tech, a short order cook. A spectroscopic chemist, a pet store owner, dog trainer, high school teacher. He had all these jobs.
Did he like them?
Yes.
It sounds like,
yeah.
From the way that you were saying that, I was like, I bet he actually liked all of
them. He liked all of those jobs, and he was good at all those jobs. Mm-hmm. And what I've come to realize, and I don't think he would have articulated it this way, but his work is the through line that connects all those jobs. His work was helping humans and animals thrive.
Mm.
That was his work.
So whether you're teaching high school or you're a vet tech, you're helping sentient beings thrive.
Living creatures, right? Yeah. So that to me, that distinction of work and jobs. Yeah, I always use this to come back to music for a second. KRS-One said, "Rap is something you do, hip hop is something you live."
Yeah,
and so I've adapted that. Like a job is something you do, and your work is something you live.
Well, it sounds like your dad was very inspirational for you.
Oh my gosh, yes, absolutely, absolutely.
Because it didn't necessarily matter what he was doing; he was still going to be him, and he was going to bring his purpose to it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And he was a weirdo, man.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if you've seen any pictures of my dad.
No.
I look eerily like him. Yeah. Like
it's, wait, did he have the mustache too?
He did. Not in this format, but he had a distinctive mustache.
Yeah.
And he dressed, so he grew up in the East Coast. He was born in the Bronx. Mm-hmm. Grew up in like South Florida, moved here as an adult, moved to Colorado as an adult, but he always envisioned himself as a cowboy. And so he came to Colorado and he dressed like the Marlboro Man. Like my dad had a style that was like Western from head to toe. He had, when he died, I found 168 belt buckles.
168 belt buckles?
Yeah. I still have them. You want them?
Yeah. What about bolo ties?
He had a bolo tie period, but it wasn't something that really defined him. His belt buckles were like the thing people knew him by.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah.
So fast forward for me a little bit, you know, the late 90s is when you start to get into this stuff, not just working at a job, but working at thinking about work and talking about work. And so how did that, you know, become your work?
A lot of, I'm highly autodidactic, right? So I'm just like, I get interested in something and I teach myself all about it.
Yeah.
And, so the company that I worked for that was owned by GE, I worked there for 10 years. Mm-hmm. GE then sold the company to a company that did not have a compelling vision for what they wanted me to do next. Mm. And so I took a package and I was laid off.
Yeah.
Amazing. Incredible. I was like, I'm going to be a consultant. Mm. All right. A consultant on what, Eric? I don't know. What do you got? You know, like, I'll do it. So I had like 6 months of severance. Mm. Incredible. And I spent through it. And I took some like unrelated consulting gigs. Just people would call me up and be like, hey, we need somebody to teach us how to use Microsoft Project. I'm like, okay, I'll read the dummy's guide and I'll come teach you. Like, it was stupid. But I made some money. At the end of my first year of that, I was totally broke. And I owed the IRS like $6,000.
Wow.
Yeah. Which I, by the way, borrowed from my ex-wife.
Hmm.
Low point.
Low point.
So I then was like, I gotta get a job. And this friend of mine who I'd worked with at GE was working at this company, and she was like, we need you. Like, I can hire you like tomorrow. Like, and I had heard about this company. I had heard terrible things about this company as a place to work. I'd heard they were like, it was really rough. But I needed a job.
Work, yeah.
And they paid really well. They paid really well. So I was like, okay, I'll take it. And going and working in this really dysfunctional culture is what made me aware of culture.
Yeah, yeah.
That it's like
you saw how bad it could be.
Yeah. It's like, you know, the cliche is like, you know, you can't tell a fish what water is, right? It's like that, and like all of a sudden the water is on fire.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, there's water here and it's on fire. Like, it was like that. And so then I was like, oh, what is this? Hmm. What makes this what it is? Hmm. Like, this place, people wouldn't say hello to each other in the hallways. Like, literally, I have a vivid memory of walking by a guy in a hallway, complete stranger, and I just said, how's it going? And he flinched visibly. Like, you're not supposed to do that. It's basically what that told me, you know, like that we don't do that here.
Yeah.
And so that got me really interested in like, how does one arrive at different kinds of cultures? And that, by the way, applies outside the workplace, right?
Like, sure.
It applies in family units. It applies, you know, anytime you get more than like three people together habitually.
Have you read this book, The Body Keeps the Score?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, you just reminded me of when he says, you know, don't ask the question, what's wrong with you? Say, what happened to you?
Yes. You know? Yeah, that's so good. Yeah. That's so good. And that is a really nice way of thinking about culture, because, you know, what I have learned both through study and also through just working with organizations when it became my work after that job, basically, that's not quite true. So I'll come back to your question. So after that, I was like, get me out of here. And I went to work for this company that was like, we have a great culture. We have a slide. Mm-hmm. And you can make cappuccinos and there are scooters to get from building to building. It's so cool. It's a great culture. Mm-hmm. And about 3 months in, I was like, that's not what culture is. Like, that was distracting from how fucking hard it was to work there.
It was passive aggressive in a way.
It was I think it's what a lot of organizations think culture is.
Yeah.
Is like all of these distractions. Mm-hmm. And so going from really terrible culture to thinks it's a good culture, but it's at a surface level.
Yeah.
Made me go, ooh, what is this? And when I left that place is when I started really working with organizations on culture.
Yeah. Where does the second experience play into how you're currently saying, and I want you to explain this to me and,
sure.
and anybody who you know listens or reads you, but how does that second experience play into this notion of don't engage mm-hmm. employees?
Yes.
I really want that to be
delineated
for yeah. me. Don't engage employees.
Perfect. There's a couple of reasons for that idea of stop engaging employees. Mm. So the first is I want to shift the conversation away from how do you get people to do things mm-hmm. that they don't want to do, which is so much of the conversation in like management.
Mm.
It's how do you get people to do things? So I want to shift the conversation away from that because I believe in our own individual agency and self-efficacy.
Mm.
I believe that it's disrespectful to treat people as if they are there to be something different than what they are.
Wow. Yeah. What percentage of employers think that way?
I don't even know if it's a thought.
Right.
Right. It's so ingrained.
Yeah.
I mean, I get people coming to me all the time. How do we get employees to be more productive, more motivated, more customer focused, more detail oriented, whatever the thing is? Like, you hired these people.
Yeah. So how much of that is just yeah. in the very short-sighted interview process
mm.
where you look at somebody's resume and you say, do you think you can do this job? And they go, yeah. And then 90 days later, you're like, you actually aren't right for this in any way. Like,
yeah.
why not have a larger conversation about who a person is when they
come in? And there are folks who are, and I'm not an expert in like in hiring and that kind of stuff, but there are folks who are trying new things in that area. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think even just, this isn't that new, but even just contract to hire is a way of saying, let's try each other out.
Yeah, yeah. Oh,
let's sure. get to know each other. Like, let's not get married on the second date. Like, that doesn't go well, usually.
Yeah.
Usually, I should say, you know, there are exceptions.
There are a lot of employers who are hiring people and saying, move yourself and your family all the way across the country.
Right.
You know, to have this job be your life based on a 15-minute Zoom call.
Absolutely. Well, I think yes, that's a problem. And I also think that there is this mindset and mindset, it might not even be the right word because it is, I don't know that it's conscious, of a manager or a leader's job is to get people to do stuff.
Mm.
And I think a leader's job is to help people become the best versions of themselves
yeah.
through their work. And that so that's one of the reasons for stop engaging employees. The other one is that what real engagement is at work, and this is a problem, right? Because what do we mean when we say employee engagement? I define it as an authentic emotional connection and commitment
mm-hmm.
to our work. Authentic emotional connection and commitment. And you can't make somebody have that.
Right.
Any more than you can make somebody fall in love with you. Like, it's just you mm-hmm. can't, and it's not ethical to try.
Yeah.
So engagement is something that we develop. It's a condition that we develop. So if leaders focus on creating, cultivating the conditions in which that's more likely to happen, and they do that by looking after humans, human needs,
yeah.
human aspirations, human fears, human motivations. Looking after that then helps people become the best versions of themselves.
But you're talking about the employers and the employees.
That's right.
So how much of your job is kind of giving therapy to bad employers in a way?
Therapy to bad employers? How do you
yeah.
mean?
Yeah. They're coming to you saying this isn't working out.
Mm. Oh, okay,
and
gotcha.
And you're saying, I'm assuming, yeah. sometimes you're saying, maybe it's also you.
Yeah, it's the majority yeah. of my time.
Yeah.
Because again, this, it's so interesting. Like, we are so good at seeing people as somehow different from ourselves.
Right, right.
We're so good at that. And so I'll tell you a story. So early in the pandemic, like late March 2020, multiple people came to me and said, how can we keep employees motivated and productive mm-hmm. now that they're working from home?
Yeah.
And my response to that was, wrong question.
Hmm.
How do you keep them safe?
Hmm.
How do you keep them feeling cared for? That other shit will take care of itself if you take care of that stuff, right? So, like, at the beginning of the pandemic, we were at, like, the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? We're like, make sure people survive.
Yeah.
Quit talking about how do I make sure that they, you know, tick off the right number of boxes in a day or whatever it is. So very often, and I do this with love because nobody's trying to be shitty. Most people aren't trying to be shitty. Some yeah. people are trying to be shitty. Most people aren't trying to be shitty, right? Most people aren't trying to exploit other people. Most people aren't trying to be extractive. But it's so built into the systems and mm-hmm. it's so built into the assumptions of the game that they end up doing it. And then they go, wait, this isn't working. Like, why is everybody quitting, for example?
Yeah.
Well, because we're not taking care of each other as humans.
Yeah.
And we're viewing our fellow humans as instruments to accomplish other things.
Yeah, like the help.
Yes, you right. know. Yeah. Yeah, and it's it really, like, this to me, like, there's an element of, like, you can read my book as a leadership book, or you can read my book as freaking activism.
Wow.
Because there is an element of that.
Yeah.
For sure. There is an element of we need real change to really be able to take care of each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, what you said about the... I never say post-pandemic because we're really still in a pandemic.
Yeah.
But, you know, post-lockdown, you know.
Yeah.
Post... being scared to go to the grocery store or,
yes.
or whatever.
Yeah.
But even if someone survived literally and didn't die from COVID or have, you know, long-term health issues because of it, we're all, as employees, as parents, as students, whatever we are, we're all traumatized by what happened.
Yep.
And then you could go further, and speaking of the body keeps the score, even without the pandemic, we are all traumatized human beings. So
yes.
as an employer, I'm sure that's not talked about much by right. most employers, but you are working with or you are hiring a group of traumatized individuals, and
right,
you have to think of them that way, and that doesn't mean that you use kid gloves and treat them like it's preschool,
right?
You know, but you have to treat them as people.
You just have to know it. that every one of us has shit going on. You
yeah,
know,
yeah.
I was saying, like, so I mentioned, you know, my dad passed away during kind of still lockdown-y times.
Yeah.
I spend most of my day on video calls, like most of my day. And, you know, we've all got virtual backgrounds. And yeah. I was thinking, how cool would it be if on everybody's virtual background was an explanation of what's going on in their background of their life?
Yeah.
You know, like, what if I just had behind me, like, my dad died recently.
Right.
You know, and somebody else could have, like, my cat's sick. You know, whatever it is, whatever your thing is that's going on for you. And I do think, not to make this about the pandemic, but I do think the conversation about people being whole at work really came to the fore thanks to the pandemic. And
yeah.
I think that's really good because I do think there's more employers having conversations about employee mental health. That doesn't mean that managers in organizations should be trying to be therapists at all. But it means they should be trained to look out for things.
At least say, you know, are you okay? What do you need?
Mm-hmm.
Or at the very basic level, you know, there are employers who go years without saying to someone who they see every day the question, how are you? Literally yeah. never say that.
Right. You know? Right. I remember a leader I worked with years ago, and I was doing kind of employee engagement work inside this corporation, you know, as an employee. And I was talking about what has evolved to be the content of my book, essentially, mm-hmm. which is like, what are the things that leaders should do to cultivate these kinds of conditions?
Yeah.
What are the practices? Because it's not steps. It's not, you know, take these six steps. It's six practices that you do all the time. Mm-hmm. But I remember I was talking to a leader and we were talking about how you talk to somebody who has less power than you in the organization. Yeah. And he said to me, I don't have time to be nice.
Mm.
Yeah.
The first thing I would say is, do you have time to be kind?
Well, right, right.
You don't have to, you don't have
Agreed, right, right. But he would say no. He'd say, I got to get shit done.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have a friend who says that that speed contains a kind of violence.
Yeah.
And I think in the workplace that's definitely true, because there is most workplaces have an overdeveloped sense of urgency, because there's, you know, got to be first to market or got to be, you know, whatever. Those things are true. Those are like economic realities. Mm. And when we are rushing, the thing that gets short shrift is humans. Always.
Yeah, and unhealthy stress level is physically unhealthy
too. 100%. Yes. Yeah. But also, even in, you know, if you look at like when we're in a rush, we're less likely to handle diversity well.
We make more mistakes.
we make more mistakes, just simple mistakes. Yeah. But we also are more likely to actually harm people.
Mm.
In our speed, and so I think that notion, like what he said, like I don't have time to be nice. It speaks to the system in which he felt he was working.
Yeah,
you know, and that's part of what I'm trying to take on. That sounds like I'm battling something. Just like trying to address, help with, is this notion that there are structures that we are working within that we can quietly disrupt with kindness, I think.
Yeah, and we can change stories we tell ourselves about not only what everyone else should do, you know, which I feel like sometimes it takes the focus off of how we're behaving and what we're doing.
Yeah.
But then also, in my case, a lot of times I've made the mistake of telling myself so many stories of everything I have to do and I can't ask anybody for help.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so it goes both ways.
It does. But, I mean, I think, too, that some of that, that I can't ask for help thing, is related to this cultural mythos we have about, like, the individual, right? The rugged individualist kind of thing, which is a crock of shit. Like, we all know that we are all highly interdependent. Mm-hmm. Like, nobody gets anything meaningful done all alone.
Yeah.
And so I think we come to work with that notion of I can't ask for help, right?
Mm.
And then while we're at work, and this is what I want to get to about kind of how culture works. While we're at work, we experience things that tell us you're expected to not ask for help. You're expected to handle everything.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We have these experiences at work over time where we develop this belief or assumption that we are expected to, for example, go fast or handle everything ourselves or not rock the boat. Whatever the thing is.
It's ironic because a lot of times I get worried when people aren't asking questions.
Mm.
That makes me very worried.
It's it should. It should.
You're actually going to make a lot of mistakes if you're so convinced that you shouldn't ask any questions. You should act like you know everything already.
Right. You know? Right. Which is not. Yeah, it doesn't help us, you know, get on the spaceships. Like, it's not in Bill Hicks terms. Like, it's not going to get us anywhere.
Yeah.
And I feel like we are on. I tied all of this work that I do, this work about workplace culture, to human liberation, to human flourishing, and that requires undoing some stuff. And some of that stuff has to do with just how we view other people. And this notion of, do you know who Adrienne Marie Brown is?
No, I don't think so.
One of my favorite books of all time, Emergent Strategy, Adrienne Marie Brown. It's the kind of book that I will be reading the rest of my life. Like some people read the Bible. I just like open it up and read it. But she talks about this notion of like, when we meet coworkers and we're like, oh, what, not consciously, but what can they do for me?
Right.
What is this person to me? What do we do together? And we look at them, like, what we can do with them, instead of saying like kind of your point about like, not what's wrong with you, but what happened to you.
Yeah. Who are you?
Not like, what can you do for me, but who are you?
Yeah.
What have you made of yourself? Like, what have you done in your life? Let's find out. You know, like, that is not the mindset of most workplaces.
Yeah.
It's not what's encouraged. It's not what's cultivated. And so,
that's why it's so good, I think, to have interviews that are long and in depth and not just about work. Not only to say, oh, that's cute, this hobby that you're into, but just like, are you a curious human being?
Yeah, how do you
and
think?
If you're not, that might be bad. That might not work out.
Right. You know? Well, curiosity, man, that is such a, like, such a key leadership trait. Mm-hmm. The absence of curiosity is just the death knell, I feel like, of any kind of progress or learning.
Yeah.
And I don't mean just individually. I mean like organizationally.
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember I had this experience. So all of these stories that I have are like, how did I get to be doing this work in some ways? But like, I remember sitting down with the COO of a company, chief operating officer of a company where I was working. And I was like, hey, I happened to be having lunch with him, you know, at this like training thing. And I was like, you know what? I don't actually know like what the mission is of this company. And he said to me, we're going to be a $14 billion company in 2 years. Mm. And I was like, I understand that that's like the financial goal, and I can see how that's important to like shareholders. I said, but you know, like for employees, like what's the reason that this company exists? What's the reason that employees are getting out of bed every morning and you know, come to this place? And he said, employees should come here to help us become a $14 billion company. Mm. To me, what that is this understanding that like people exist to serve the organization.
Yeah.
When the way that organizations have come to be is when we realized, oh, we can get more done together than individually. Mm-hmm. Like we created organizations to serve humans, not humans to serve organizations. And his viewpoint, which I don't think is uncommon, was like, no, come here and help a handful of people get very wealthy. and you know, the economics of that aside, no human is a bit player in somebody else's story, right? We're all like the main character in our story, you know? And like to view people that way as like, thank goodness you were born so you could help us become a $14 billion company. Like,
did you watch A Christmas Carol this year?
Yes, multiple versions.
Bob Cratchit is more than a bit character. I mean, look at like how big of a role he plays in Scrooge's life and how much time Scrooge spends with him.
Right.
Yeah, right. That might be a story that you think about a lot. With what you do.
Well, I was actually thinking about it when we saw the production at the Denver Center, which was quite good, and different this year, which I appreciated. And there's a line at the beginning that Jacob Marley has, you know, where Scrooge is trying to sort of like justify how Marley was in life.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, well, you know, you had a business to run, basically, you know, like, yeah. And people say this all the time, right? Like, business exists to make money. No, it doesn't. I'll get back to that. But Jacob Marley angrily says, mankind should have been my business.
Yeah. Or in the Bill Murray version, he says, kindness should have been my
business.
Yep.
I watched that one this year again, too. It's one of my favorites, actually. Yeah. I love Scrooged so much.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you a ridiculous question.
Okay.
We can just zip the lightning round. And then I just, you know, want to also do sort of a lightning round, you know, just about the genesis of your book and the release and all this stuff. So,
sure.
Real quick. If you were stranded in a remote Colorado cabin,
sure,
in the event of a zombie apocalypse and only had food and water and a crank-powered Victrola, what 5 vinyl albums would you want?
Yeah. You're springing this on me.
Yeah.
And I have not thought about it in advance.
First thought, best thought. Jack Kerouac.
By the way, I need to tell you about the fact that I went to summer writing program.
Oh, nice.
When I was 16. It's a whole thing. But to your question. So the first one that comes to mind is the double album Jeff Buckley Live at Chennai.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
That is an album I could listen to forever.
What a singer. What a performer.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I mean, and a, you know, a dude in the corner of a coffee shop with a Telecaster?
Yeah.
Playing this gorgeous music, like the telly's not made for that, you know, there's so much about that that just like shouldn't work. And I did not appreciate him in life. I didn't, I think just because of when he came out, which was like everything was alternative, you know, and I was just skeptical of all of it. I was a college radio DJ at the time. So I didn't come to him till after his death. But so Live at Chennai, they originally just released as a 4-song like promo to sell Grace.
Right.
It was just like a Sony promo material. And then after his death, they released the full recordings, the double album.
I remember when that came out. I was in college working for the Pitt News at the University of Pittsburgh. And that was like a review copy that came out.
Of the Live at Chennai?
Yeah, of the double.
It's jaw-dropping. And especially to hear him, like, his own songs, absolutely. But his interpretations of other people's songs. You know, there's a ton of Dylan.
Yeah.
There's Nina Simone. There's Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, which he does note perfect somehow.
Yeah, he was a genius.
Like, incredible. So that's record number one.
All right, number two.
Record number two. Gosh. It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back by Public Enemy.
Nice, man.
Yeah.
That is unexpected. Yeah. As a guy from, like, Boulder, birthed.
Huge hip-hop fan.
Yeah.
A huge hip-hop fan forever.
Well, you name-dropped
KRS-One.
KRS-One as well.
Yeah. You know, so just my musical education, just briefly. Mm. When I was a kid growing up here, the local public television station, Channel 12, which still exists, KBDI, still exists. They had a show that was originally called FMTV, and then because of a lawsuit, they had to change it to Teletoons, but it was music videos.
Yeah.
And I didn't have cable, so I didn't have MTV, I just had this. And there were so few music videos that they would just play whatever. So there would be like Devo, ABC, Eric B. and Rakim, Robert Palmer. And to me, it was all just music. Like, I didn't know genres. So I remember specifically to come to hip-hop, Eric B. and Rakim, Microphone Fiend.
Yeah.
I was just like, that is a really cool, weird song.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't know it as being anything different from Devo. You know, like, it didn't, really didn't, like, it took me a while before I actually, like, took me till college to really appreciate hip-hop as a genre. I just had been a hip-hop fan without knowing it.
Yeah.
Nation of Millions specifically... I think I think as I list these off, like they're going to come from a period of time of my life. I don't think that's surprising. Yeah. But it's so powerful. Yeah. It still is. Some of the samples, because it was still a time when clearance wasn't such an issue, wasn't such a big deal. Like some just incredibly insane samples. I think the triumvirate of Chuck D, Flava Flav, and Terminator X, and then the Bomb Squad as the fourth member. Could listen to that all day. Number three. This one is weird, and I'm cursed by recency bias.
Okay.
Things that have just that I've recently listened to. But I recently was listening to an album by a group called In the Nursery.
I haven't heard of them.
In the Nursery were, I think they were on Wax Trax maybe records. I was a big industrial head for a minute. But In the Nursery did this kind of this weird combination of industrial and film score kind of classical, not real classical, but film score classical. And this particular record, which I can't remember what it's called right now, but this particular record uses samples of a guy reading the poem Desiderata. Do you know the poem?
No, I don't think I know.
It's a gorgeous piece of work from 1927, from this American poet.
Yeah, I can't wait to listen.
Max Ehrmann, Desiderata. So it had all these it has all these little clips of him. Of this guy, I don't know who, reading over this industrially classical music. So it's the kind of stuff that can be in the background.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to focus on it, but also rewards being focused on. So
Do you remember a band called Meat Beat Manifesto?
Oh, Storm the Studio.
Yeah.
I mean, Storm the Studio maybe should be on the list.
Yeah.
That particular album, double album again.
Yeah.
You know, people talk about double albums as being shitty. Have you heard this? There's a terrible music podcast called Your Favorite Band Sucks. Have you listened to this?
Yeah, I hate that.
It's terrible. This is going to be I expect it to be smart and interesting and finding ways to it's just dumb.
Haters
it's just throwing feces, it's super dumb. Yeah. But they did a whole thing where they were talking about how much double albums are the worst.
I just feel like if you're gonna put out a double album, it better be good. You better justify why you need all that.
Well, and I think no pun intended, but Jeff Buckley's Live at Chennai double, Storm the Studio double. And frankly, Frankie Goes to Hollywood's first album, Welcome to the Terror Dome. Welcome to the Terror Dome is Public Enemy. Welcome to the Pleasure Dome.
Yeah,
that's funny. Those are all three manifestos. Those are as a work.
Yeah,
they're bam.
Look at London Calling or something like that. I don't think that double albums suck. I think. Like I said, if you're going to put out a double album, it better be good. You better show why you needed to use all those tracks.
Yes, I think that's so important. And I think can we talk about Storm the Studio? Because holy shit, that's a good one, and I want to put that on my list now because you
mentioned that's your number four.
Mentioned Meat Beat Manifesto. Yes,
Subliminal Sandwich is the one that I.
Oh, see, no, I really, so really by like. That era, I was less interested.
Yeah.
What I love about Storm the Studio. Storm the Studio was heavily hip-hop influenced.
Yeah, right.
At Storm the Studio, they had a DJ. By Subliminal Sandwich, they did not. By the Subliminal Sandwich, it was basically Jack Danger making things, which is cool, too. Don't get me wrong. That stuff is interesting. But Storm the Studio was heavy hip-hop influence. I love sample-based music. And the samples that the guy, I can't remember his real name, but the DJ went by Greg Retch, which is just a funny DJ name. But he would bring in these crazy samples, and Jack Dangers was too. He was obviously a huge part of it. And then Jack was essentially rapping. Mm-hmm. And then there were like these industrial noise and that. So that double album, it technically only has 4 songs, but like each of those songs has like 4 movements that are completely different.
That's a good zombie apocalypse record.
It is. It really is.
And double albums in general are good for the zombie apocalypse.
Well, yeah, it's kind of a cheat, right? It's a cheat code for the...
Yeah. And by the way, Jack Dangers
is
an amazing guy. He lives up north of San Francisco.
Yeah.
And a bunch of my friends in the Mill Valley, Muir Beach area have known him for a long time.
And oh, really?
Got to hang out with him
nice
a bunch of times at parties and geek out about music. He's from Swindon in England, which is where XTC is from.
Yep.
And he was really interested in music as a kid, and somehow one of the reasons he got so into engineering and industrial music is such a big deal. But when XTC was making English Settlement, which is, I love that record.
It's incredible.
He just like walked in and was just sitting on an amp, just like watching everything. And it was great to to meet him and talk about that. But that's a random band that like only a certain kind of music geek of a certain age.
Yeah, I think that's true. Well, there's around that same scene, around that like Bay Area weirdo scene of the late 80s, early 90s, Mark Pistol, who did like Consolidated.
That's way before my time. I know about bands like Meat Beat Manifesto and Pop Elite itself and all of that because Trent Reznor started Nothing Records and signed all of these great
all bands from the past, the world, right? Absolutely, Well, the what is his name? Michael Franti.
Yeah,
right. So Michael Franti was part of that weirdo scene. The Disposable Heroes of Hypocrisy. And before that, he had a group called the Beatniks.
Yeah,
which was weirdly industrial. And like Disposable Heroes, super cool and weird.
Yeah,
first couple of Spearhead records, really interesting.
A lot of people don't know that Michael Franti didn't always just make music for Corona commercials, you know.
Right. Right. I mean he's become sort of like a Jack Johnson-y kind of, and there's nothing wrong with that. Like people love him and he's still he's spreading a positive message and I love that. And I liked when he was musically a little bit more of a weirdo.
Yeah. Okay, one album left.
Shit. I know I'm forgetting so many of my like all-time favorite albums. But I'm going to go with something that's a little risky, politically speaking.
All right.
The very first Red House Painters record.
Oh, wow.
The first self-titled Red House Painters
record. Have you heard Mark Kozelek's song, The War on Drugs Can Suck My Cock?
No, I have not.
Sounds right. He is really talented and like... His own like character in a movie, who you would hate. He would be the most hateable character.
100%. 100%. So I'll tell you a Kozelek story, a personal one. And you know, in recent years, like stuff has come out about him being kind of a sexual predator and a creep.
Yeah.
So that is true. That is a thing. And he made fucking incredible music.
Yeah.
The first, actually, as a music journalist, I don't know if I've ever told you this, the first thing I ever wrote, so I wrote for Hybrid Magazine, which Dave Herrera started before he was the music Dave editor Herrera. At Westward. A buddy of mine at GE was writing book reviews for this online magazine. This would be like 2000. And he was like, well, if you ever want to write about music, you should, you know, send him a sample. And I had just bought Mark Kozelek's first solo record, which was What's Next to the Moon. It's all AC/DC covers. It's gorgeous.
Yeah, I remember that.
It's gorgeous. And I wrote like 1,500 word review of this album, you know, just insane, and sent it to Dave Herrera. And he was like, oh, who the hell are you? Like, yeah, let's do this. You know? Yeah. So that's how I started writing about music.
That's great.
But that was not my actual Kozelek story. So my actual Kozelek story is, I went to see Red House Painters. 96-ish probably, at the Boulder Theater. And there was a girl, teenage girl, standing at the apron of the stage, just gazing up adoringly at Kozelek. Mm-hmm. He's a good-looking guy, and he makes this beautiful music, you know? Yeah. And she's wearing this way oversized, like down to her knees, Joy Division t-shirt. Kind of a cliche, you know, like, yeah. But you know, like she was in love. Like she was absolutely, you know, and he was in the middle of a song and he just kind of sneered at her and then started playing a really shitty cover of Level Tear Us Apart.
Yeah.
Like intentionally bad and like looking at her. And I was just like, that's a dick move. Like, why you gotta be a dick? Like, she likes Joy Division and she likes you. You should be flattered. Don't be a dick, right? So anyway, that happened. I told people that story for years. Mm. Years later, I see him solo at the Larimer Lounge. And it's like an everybody's sitting down. Mm. He's getting pissed because people are at the bar talking. You know, he's completely intolerant of it. But he's playing and he was in a really good mood. And he was like letting people make requests and stuff. And this woman over here asks him to play Level Tear Us Apart. And I was like, that's weird. And he played a beautiful version. Like, gorgeous. Like, all the words, you know, like, wasn't like making fun of it. Played it straight. Played it in his style. It was beautiful. And I was like, what a weird moment. And so the show ends, and people are milling about, and I walk over to this woman. I'm like, what made you request Love Will Tear Us Apart? And she said, oh, I saw them at the Boulder Theater on my 16th birthday, and he played that song just for me.
Oh, that's awesome.
And so, like, her version of the story was so different from mine. Like, her version was, he played that song just for me, and now he just did it again. That's amazing.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, cool. Like, why did I have to have this story about him being a dick? And she had this story about him being really generous, which I thought was amazing.
Yeah, well, maybe we can tie that into like workplace culture, because
maybe so. So Red House Painter's first album, that came out around the time I was in my early mid 20s, I guess. And there's a song on there called 24, and about turning 24 and feeling like, oh my God, my life is over, kind of thing. A very self-indulgent, you know, song that a 24-year-old might write. And I still think it's a beautiful song, especially now that we're in 2024.
Yeah.
And I'm like, ooh, I'm going to revisit that song.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So, is this your first book? I just want to hear, I mean, sort of the Cliff's Notes of, like, how it came to exist and, you know, who's involved with it, what your hopes are for it.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. How it came to be was, you know, constantly having these conversations about workplace culture and employee engagement and not having an approach that I really believed in. Mm-hmm. Everything I kept bumping into just didn't feel true.
Yeah.
And it didn't feel, some of it didn't feel ethical because it was like about getting people to do stuff, right? And so I developed this framework, these six E's. Hmm. They're all E's. I developed it years ago and, you know, used it here and there with clients, whether it was consulting or whether it was, you know, speaking or whatever, and just continued to evolve it over time. And there's an instrumental reason for writing a book. And then there's the sort of the pure reason for writing the book. Both are true. One, so the instrumental one, to get that out of the way, is like, I am trying to do more and more speaking. Mm-hmm. I find that I make the greatest contribution, I have the most fun, and I'm the best at speaking among the things that I can do. Mm. Speaking and writing. Not so much consulting. I can and do consulting, and I do it well, but it's not my favorite thing.
Yeah.
So I want to do more speaking. You get more speaking when you have a book. That's just true.
Right.
So that's the instrumental. And then the non-instrumental is I believe that the ideas in this book can actually help make people's lives better. And so that's why I want to put it out. So I wrote it I wrote the first draft in 7 days.
Wow.
I took some time, and it's just like, I'm gonna just write every day, and I'm not gonna edit. I'm not gonna research.
I'm just gonna write.
I'm just gonna write. Yeah. And I had been speaking about this, so like all the material was in my head. I knew the organization pretty well, and so I wrote the first draft in 7 days. In November 2020, mm-hmm. I handed it over to an editor, a friend of mine, an amazing editor, not for commas, you know, but for structural editing.
Yeah.
And she gave me back incredible feedback. Like she really, like she actually read the book and mm-hmm. and interacted with the ideas in the book yeah. and like asked me really hard questions, and it was incredible. And I got it back, and I didn't know what to do with it because I'd never written a book before.
Yeah.
And so what I did was nothing for a long time.
Yeah.
It just sort of sat.
Right.
Like I literally, like I printed it out because I'm that age. Like I printed out the book with like her marginalia.
Notes, yeah.
And I was like, I don't know what to do with this. And so finally, beginning of 2023, I again blocked out time and just went through it page by page. And in those intervening years, from November 2020 to January 23, I had given talks, I had worked with clients, my thinking had evolved. And so I made significant edits. Yeah. I incorporated her ideas, but I also made significant edits. And the biggest thing that changed about the book was the first version of the book was, here's how you can create a great culture
yeah.
so that you can be more profitable, be more productive, all mm-hmm. those things. This version of the book is, here's how to create a workplace culture that takes care of humans, because that's all that matters.
Yeah.
And the rest of the stuff will take care of itself. There's plenty of books out there that can tell you how to be more profitable and more productive. I'm not shitting on those at all.
That's not your book.
It's just not my book.
Yeah.
Right? So who's involved? So I'm self-publishing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm using Ingram Spark, which is basically a self-publishing platform that then hooks into global distribution. So it's available, like it's available for pre-order right now on like mm-hmm. Amazon and Barnes and Noble, but it'll be available on like bookshop.org so people can order it from independent yeah. bookstores. The other thing that I want to talk about in terms of who's involved, because I appreciate mm-hmm. that question. After I wrote it, I was like, I'm a word guy. You're a word guy. This is how I understand the world, but that's not how everybody understands the world.
Right.
And especially not how everybody understands these kind of heady topics that I'm talking about. I knew I needed illustrations, right? I need images in my book. And I got, amazingly, through a friend of a friend, I got introduced to this guy who wrote one of my favorite books about writing of all time. Nonfiction writing. It's called Writing Without Bullshit.
Hmm.
Josh Burnoff. It's incredible.
I'll have to check it out.
Great book. Check it out. I read Josh's book. It's become like my Bible for nonfiction writing. And I got introduced to Josh. And I had this great conversation with him because, like, during peak pandemic times, you could just talk to people.
Right.
You know, people would be like, yeah, sure, I'll meet with you. Mm-hmm. And I had, like, an hour-long conversation. He was incredibly generous. And he was like, well, I can introduce you to illustrators.
Yeah.
Like, I edit business books all the time. He's like, no problem. So he introduced me to some people. They sent me their stuff. And I was like, oh, this is really good and totally wrong for my book.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know it till I saw it because I'm not visual that way. Yeah. But, like, as soon as I saw it, I was like, oh, no.
Right.
Like, I don't want like perfectly pressed charts and graphs. You know? I want it to be human. Like, that's the whole point of the book. Right? Because the subtitle of the book is, so Stop Engaging Employees, subtitle is Start Making Work More Human.
Yeah.
So I want it to feel human. And so a weird thing that happened at the beginning of the pandemic, I published an article on LinkedIn and Medium that was essentially using this 6 E's framework to answer that question of how can we keep people motivated and productive mm-hmm. while they're working from home. It was basically like flipping things on its head and saying, this is what we should be doing. And I wrote that. I remember I was in Desert Hot Springs, California, helping my mother-in-law. And I published this article. And I woke up the next morning, and on LinkedIn, a person who I'd never met before, who lives in Cape Town, South Africa, had created a hand-drawn infographic version of my article.
And it was exactly what you wanted.
Yes.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. This woman is not an illustrator. She's not an artist. She does this thing called sketch notes, which is basically like visual note-taking.
Yeah.
And so after I'd seen these incredible corporate drawings, I went to her and I was like, look, she runs a company out of Cape Town that does leadership training. So she's like a very busy entrepreneur.
Yeah.
And I was like, I know that you've got a whole thing to do, but would you consider being the illustrator for my book? And she was like, absolutely. I had done some speaking gigs for her, for her company, which is amazing. I got to speak all over Africa from my basement in Longmont during the pandemic.
That's awesome.
And so she was like, yeah, I owe you. I'm like, I'll do it. It took forever because she's busy.
Yeah.
But ultimately, the illustrations I've got are so perfect for the book. And they serve a couple of purposes. So one is they just feel human. Like an actual human drew these. Like somebody who, an early reader of the book, called them childish in a derogatory sense.
Yeah, but you took it as...
But childlike is more right? Yeah. And so there's a naivete to it. Mm-hmm. But there's also just like a... This book is for anybody.
Yeah.
This book isn't for... This isn't just for people with MBAs.
Yeah.
Or, you know, or whatever. And so I think the illustrations say that. Like, even when you see the cover...
Yeah.
The cover is a stop sign being overgrown by vines.
Mm-hmm.
Because I use throughout the book this metaphor of gardening for leadership instead of carpentry. And it's beautiful and it doesn't look like a business book.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, I really hope that, you know, the book gets into a lot of workplaces and has a lot of, you know,
thanks, man,
positive effect. And thanks. I hope that it gets you onto a lot more, you know, stages where you can talk about this stuff, you know.
Thanks, man. That's the hope.
As you said, like that is really your I don't want to say like your only talent or your only strength, but you're really fucking good at it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, here's the thing, like when I do coaching, I do coaching with all kinds of different people, but I always say like cuz people talk about like, how do you pick the thing you do, you know? And I'm like, it's the thing you're good at. And not only the thing you're good at, but the thing you're better at than most people you know.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
There's the thing that, where you make your greatest contribution.
Yeah.
And then there's the thing that you enjoy.
Yeah.
And when you have that overlap of those three things, and for me, speaking and writing are those things. Yeah. Like I do them better than most people I know. There's tons of people who are better, but, you know, looking around King Supers, you know, like I do it most better than most people I know. I love doing it. And it is the way that I make a great contribution versus a lot of other things I could be doing.
Well, why don't you rattle off,
yeah,
you know, like for people interested in reading the book, just as quick as you can, what are the six E's?
Six E's. The first one is empathize. So it's really about listening and getting to understand what people need and what's getting in their way.
Yeah.
The second E is encourage. It's about encouraging people to get involved, to be a part of what's happening, as opposed to being recipients of what to do.
Yeah.
The third E is educate. It's not about training. It's about educating one another to arrive at a shared understanding of what's important, why it's important, and what each person's role is.
Yeah.
That's educate. The fourth E is enable. That is making sure people have the knowledge, tools, skills, resources they need. The fifth E is empower, which is about getting obstacles out of people's way that make it hard for them to do what they want to do and what you want them to do. And the sixth E is embrace, which is about noticing and celebrating the attitudes, mindsets, behaviors that are creating the kind of place we want to be.
Awesome. And, you know, thank you so much for talking with me and nerding out and
dude, thank
inspiring.
You.
And I also... I hope you would run for office someday. I think you'd be really good at that.
Thanks, man. Yeah, yeah, all right, I will.
Yeah. I'll give you another hour, then I gotta run. I gotta fly away, leave you to fall.
That was speaker, DJ, author, business consultant, and coach Eric Isle talking about workplace culture and his love of music as well. Check out Eric's new book, his debut book, Stop Engaging Employees, about, you know, humanity in the workplace, everywhere now. Everywhere you buy books, or he's also got a website, ericeyl.com. Yeah, ericeyl.com. Thanks for listening, and don't forget that we have a Mile High Stash playlist on Spotify for each year of the podcast. So one song from each album choice that our guests make is always dropped right on that. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next month with definitely the beginning of a good long stretch of girl power. We've got some great, powerful ladies who are going to be guests on the podcast in the very near future, starting next month. See you then. And in the meantime, reach out at milehighstash.com or milehighstash@gmail.com. Send me an email or, you know, reach out on the socials with suggestions, complaints, ideas, psychological evaluations, therapy, you know, whatever. All right, we'll talk soon. I were true, and I wish that were you sitting across from me instead of this impersonation of the